fun for the podcast for me to read an email to you that I received a couple of years ago. Dear Dr. Perlmutter, my daughter was your patient during your pediatric GI fellowship at Boston Children's Hospital. Prior to us getting to Boston, 11 hospitals had attempted to provide a diagnosis without success following admissions for infections and GI bleeds. Call asking you to ignore her medical records and begin anew. You did not fail her, diagnosing her with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. You'd given our enemy a name. By 1983, Trina was 2 and dying. Liver transplantation was the only glimmer of hope. Today, Trina is completing her surgery residency, and this summer will begin her transplant fellowship. I simply wanted to share some happy news and thank you for your helping hand in making it possible.
You're listening to Masterminds, where we sit down with experts in science and medicine to talk about everything from the research of today to the innovation of tomorrow. This is Mishka.
And this is Will. And today, we sat down with Dr. David H. Perlmutter, the George and Carol Bauer Dean of Washington University School of Medicine, Executive Vice Chancellor of Medical Affairs, and the Spencer T. and Ann W. Olin Distinguished Professor. Dean Perlmutter leads one of the largest medical schools in the country, currently ranked at number 2 in NIH funding among U.S. medical schools nationwide.
He is also a pediatric gastroenterologist who is internationally known for his research on alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, or ATD, which is a genetic disorder resulting in liver damage. We hope you enjoy this episode with Dean David Perlmutter. Our first questions, we just like to ask our guests about their background. What in your childhood do you feel led you to a career in medicine?
You know, it's a mystery to me, Mishka. I don't really know, but it's deep. It was there for a long time. And I think it was always around kids. I loved being a counselor in camp. And so I was always thinking about being a pediatrician. But I don't know how to tell you what else led to it. The truth is that I had a very hard time getting into medical school. I was very lucky to get to medical school. And so it's a bit of a magical story. And I remember when I graduated from medical school, my mother looked at me and she says, "I don't know who you are." And that is a description of how surprising it was that happened for me. I was a jock and I loved to play basketball and hang out, and I wasn't really studying very much.
That's awesome. And how did you choose pediatric gastroenterology?
Yeah, as I got to be a resident, I knew that I wanted something more than to be in practice. So I had the sense that I really wanted to know why about things, and that led me to believe that I wanted to specialize. And pediatric GI is a broad specialty. You get involved in and some of the specialties are narrower. So definitely was broad enough. And then I had several patients during my residency, amazing experiences, pediatric GI problems. Amazing experiences. And so I think those formed. And when I started in pediatric GI, it was still a pretty young specialty. The pediatric GI specialty really only started in the late 1950s, early 1900s. And it was really only until the late 1970s, early 1980s, that endoscopy became practical in children. And so the specialty of pediatric gastroenterology is quite young within the field. So I ended up really feeling good about that experience.
So over the course of your career, you have held faculty positions at Harvard Medical School, WashU, the University of Pittsburgh. What brought you back to WashU?
Well, WashU is a special medical school. And I've spent a lot of time trying to describe that, and especially trying to describe that special quality in lieu of what's happening at the medical school right now. But I will also tell you, it was this job that I took, very specifically this job. And because I knew that, I knew because I had been here as a faculty member, I knew what this job, I thought I knew what this job would be. And it's been everything and more. And it really two things. Number one, to be participating in the most exciting science that the purpose of which is to improve health. And that's because this School of Medicine has been in the business of high quality research for decades and decades and decades. And so it's baked into the DNA of the place. And then secondly, it's a place, and it's because it's in the Midwest, that has to have a community to attract faculty. I mean, we compete with the best places on the East Coast and the West Coast. And one of our special, one of the things that we are special at is having a community for each other. And right now, the departments, the clinical departments, the basic science departments of the School of Medicine are growing faculty at four times the national average right in the middle of the country. And there's nobody who even comes close to that kind of special thing. So it was, you know, the special thing of WashU, but it was also the combination of things that I could do here. And to a certain extent, it was the realization of the way I comically describe myself. I'm a WashU physician scientist that went on a 15-year management sabbatical at University of Pittsburgh. And University of Pittsburgh is an incredibly well-managed, very different kind of academic medical center from WashU. And that's what's sort of the evolution of coming back. And it's been everything and more than I thought it was.
So WashU School of Medicine, it's a $3.2 billion medical center. It's the largest, third largest research intensive school of medicine in the nation. We really are at the forefront of research, drug development, and translational medicine. I mean, this new neuroscience research building that the Board of Trustees is meeting at in this week, you know, it's really a testament to that. In your tenure as dean, how have you seen the medical school grow in some of these aspects?
The biggest thing, Mishka, is that we've been able to do something very special, that is to grow in all of our missions. In the past, it's been hard for WashU to imagine that it could be great at research, clinical, and education all at once. And in a lot of ways, traditionally, medical schools like this one will say, you know, it's hard to be good at the clinical thing and the research thing. And so WashU has research. What I'm most proud of is that we continue to be great and growing at research, but at the same time, we're doing more and more to be great as a clinical provider. So it's an and, not an or. And that's, you know, it seems very simple and simplistic, and but it's not. It's not at all. Being great at clinical medicine and being ever more impactful on our communities through what we do from what we do with our clinical care is something that we've improved at, something that we're on the journey to doing even more, and there's much more we can do. And now I believe all of our department heads, all of our leadership can look at it and say, hey, that doesn't interfere with us still being research, and it doesn't interfere with us attracting the best students. And, you know, we made a big commitment to our education. In 2018, we committed $100 million over 10 years to more scholarships for students, for curriculum modernization. And so I would have to say, Mishka, the idea that the word and is what I'm most proud of.
I mean, that's a great point. You know, medicine, it's so much more than the classroom instruction and the basic science research. It's also about reaching communities. How is the School of Medicine positively impacting the greater St. Louis area? And also you mentioned work that still needs to be done. What's that work that we still need to be doing?
I mean, we are deeply committed to take care of the safety net. And we do that, Mishka, only because we believe in it. It is within our financial model. We have to do all kinds of other things in order to be able to do it, but we stay committed to it. And so anybody who's been at St. Louis Children's Hospital and at Barnes Jewish Hospital knows that we take care of the most vulnerable and the communities, urban and rural. We get people from devastating situations across the state of Missouri and across the Midwest, and we never hesitate. And now we've expanded. We're in, I think, over 70 locations in the region, and we're looking to expand even more in the future, so that we can fulfill the vision that we have for what we call the virtuous cycle of academic medicine. And that is, we're reaching as many communities as we can. We're giving the best possible care we can, but we have absolutely massive aspirations that relate to the fact that we don't believe we give good enough care, and we need to improve that through research. And that's awesome. Virtuous cycle of academic medicine is the vision for how everybody's careers fit within the paradigm of what we do. And that, by the way, is the big journey here. This is a place that has always been a great place for scientists. We are really just learning about how to also be a great place for people who whose aspirations are to be a clinician, and everything that means. The next big journey for us is, how do we take all these capabilities and turn them into more commercial products? And that's another aspect of what we do, Mishka, that's responsive to your question, that I think people don't recognize. And that is how we have helped the community, or how we continue to help the community. We not only do we take care of all of the communities and the sickest of the sickest and the most vulnerable in this community, but also through our research mission, we're lifting the economy of the region with jobs. We know that every $1 million grants is 11 jobs. So if you take our current research mission, we bring in about $800 million a year of research grants. We invest about $400 million from institutional resources. So that's $1.2 billion. That's, you can do the math, 11 jobs for every million. That's a ton of jobs. Now, the next step for us is, how do we turn that into more companies? How do we turn that into more licensing of technologies? And those bring jobs with them to the region, more economic development to the region. And ultimately, these are the kinds of levers that you want to push for the city and the state to be doing other things that elevate what happens here. Like, one of my favorites is, at some point, this city and state figure out how to invest in early education, because it's so incredibly important. So this medical school makes an enormous contribution to the community. Very few people in this community realize the depth and the breadth of that.
That's awesome. And thank you for that answer. We're also wondering, and we're going to get to your research, so hang tight for a second, but one last question about the medical school, but you specifically, what is your philosophy as a leader within academic medicine, and what are your core values that kind of ground you when you have you have an enormous job, to say the least. So what sorts of values and philosophies guide both your leadership and your approach to sort of balancing everything?
Well, there's so many answers to that, Mishka. I would say that it's really important to engage in what it is you're leading. I think oftentimes you get into the C-suite and it's very hard to remain engaged with what it is that's going on. And we're big. I mean, this is a big, as you mentioned, this is a big organization. And so one of the things I pushed myself very hard on is to remain engaged, both in the research activities, and that's easy for me because I adore science and every kind of science, that I'm still engaged in what every department is doing clinically, that I'm engaged with our education program. It definitely has been a massive plus for me in terms of being able to arrive at the right judgments and arrive at the great decisions, and more importantly, mentor our leadership, who are really the people who execute the plan, not me. I think, you know, understanding cultures and changing of cultures, understanding that we all have strengths and weaknesses, and that the, you know, the one part of what you do in leadership is enabling great things to happen. And I think what people find out about me is that, you know, I'm naturally empowering. I never see something that is the right thing to do or is the wonderful thing to do that I don't want to understand, well, why can't we do that? And so people are often surprised when they talk with me that I right away I'm thinking about, well, how can we do that? And I'm frequently asking our department heads, well, what's going to make it possible for us to do something that's never been done before? So leadership is about empowering, enabling, leveraging, making things happen that otherwise. And, you know, I have a funny phrase about that I say to the department heads. I say, you know, you're going to take a job now. This is our new department heads, and we've had a lot of new department heads number of years. And I say to them, you are going to enter into a world where everybody thinks they know what you should do. And they're going to tell you what you should do. And you're going to have to figure out, how do I do that which my nose tells me to do while everybody else is telling me what they believe I should be doing? And I've been in leadership long enough that I've had these wonderful moments where somebody will come up to me and say, you know, David, we thought you were going in the wrong direction, and now you have proven us wrong. And it's just that whole thing of, it's almost, you're listening, you're hearing, you're incorporating, but you know that you have to go on this journey. Another thing about leadership that's very important is you can't live your life in the short term. You have to be thinking about what's next after the next thing and what's next after that, because otherwise you get caught in a cycle. There's a lot more, but I'll stop there.
Thank you, Dean Perlmutter. Now, moving on to some of your clinical work as well as your research. To start, what is the typical function of a healthy liver in children? And what are some of the most common diseases associated with liver dysfunction in children?
Well, the liver is the center of metabolism for the body. It's critically important to every aspect of metabolism. The most common diseases will probably be viral hepatitis, and most of the childhood liver diseases, each of them are rare. There's a disease called erythrosis, which is a terrible disease that infants have. There's no adult counterpart to it, and most of those infants have to have a liver transplant. There are immune causes of liver disease. There's liver disease in children is a highly specialized area. I had the unique experience of starting my training just as liver transplantation was found to be successful. So I did my training in Boston between 1981 and 1984. And this was right after the most famous paper by Tom Starzl in 1980 showing that cyclosporin could be used for immunosuppression to make liver transplantation a reality. And Starzl had done that with children with biliary atresia at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, which I think you know I ended up being there for a number of years. And so it was just at that time. And when I was taking care of kids from all over the country, one thing that was great about training at Boston Children's is a very famous hospital, and it gets referrals from all over the world. And I was taking care of kids with rare liver diseases from all over the world. And those families were actually, in some cases, very famous because they went and tested gaslight in Congress about the need to have insurance companies cover the liver transplant. At that time, insurance companies weren't covering the transplant. And then others of those families would go out to raise the money necessary to pay for it. It would cost $300,000, $400,000 at that time, was a lot of money to pay for it. And it was really only being done in Pittsburgh and Minnesota at the time. So I had these unbelievable experiences with the families, really unbelievable experiences. I've never really actually talked about it, but I actually, you know, it would be fun for the podcast for me to read an email to you that I received a couple of years ago. Hang on for a second. It's in my inbox, even though it came to me. And so this came to me May 30th, 2019. Dear Dr. Perlmutter, my daughter, Trina Engbritson, was your patient during your pediatric GI fellowship at Boston Children's Hospital. Prior to us getting to Boston, 11 hospitals had attempted to provide a diagnosis without success following admissions for infections and GI bleeds. My husband, a Norwegian cruise ship captain, had already given up on American doctors ever discovering the cause of her illness. Parentheses, he rather conveniently forgot that Trina's two admissions to Norway's Rick's Hospital following bleeds did not produce a diagnosis either. I call asking you to ignore her medical records and begin anew. We'd come from Miami without my husband's knowledge, and this was a last attempt. You did not fail her, diagnosing her with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. You'd given our enemy a name. By 1983, Trina was 2 and dying. Liver transplantation was the only glimmer of hope. Insurance was denied, as this was experimental surgery. I sought funding to place her name on the list and a matching donor liver from a child who suffered brain death. Congress and Network TV debated brain death and who owns donor organs. It would take more than a village to save Trina. Ultimately, she survived with active help from King Olav of Norway, President Reagan, Disney Corporation, Dr. Thomas Starzl, and most significantly of all, the generosity of two grieving parents from Kentucky. Amidst heartbreak over the unexpected death of their infant daughter, these amazing young parents offered the gift of life to Trina through organ donation. Today, Trina is completing her surgery residency, and this summer will begin her transplant fellowship at Ochsner in New Orleans. She is married and has 2 healthy sons. I simply wanted to share some happy news and thank you for your helping hand in making it possible. I remain very grateful to you for going the extra mile to benefit your patient. It is my hope that Trina will emulate your fine example. And she sent me a picture of Trina and the two, and her husband and the 2 kids. Every time I read anything, so that was a big part of my fellowship. And you might imagine a part of what I did with my research.
That's a wonderful story. And I think it's a perfect segue into talking about ATD or alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which you have become known as an expert in this genetic liver disease. Can you start by talking about how you first got interested in it?
Well, I ended up in a lab. So at that point in time, you could do a fellowship at Boston Children's Hospital, in which it would be 1 year clinical and 2 years research. And you had to go off to pick a research experience. An amazing opportunity because you could pick a research experience anywhere in Boston. Lots of great laboratories in Boston. And I was lucky enough to get a spot in a lab that was fabulous, fabulous principal investigator. And in fact, Harvey Colton, who was my mentor, really came to WashU in 1985 to be the chair of pediatrics. And that's how I ended up at WashU. But I got a spot in Harvey's lab, which was which was not straightforward because I really did not have any research experience. I knew that, and what I said to Harvey was that, I wanted to know what it was like to be a scientist and whether I was good at it. And I wanted to know about that soon. And then I literally had a 5-minute conversation with him, and then he accepted me in the lab. And the second part of it was, do you think I could have a career in pediatric GI with the work you do in his lab? His lab was really at the forefront of complement immunology. It was not in any way really related to GI. And so I asked him that, and he put me onto a project which had to do with how the liver synthesizes and secretes one of the components of complement. He said, David, this will be good for your career in GI, which was not true, actually. It really didn't have anything to do with a pediatric GI. It was a basic cell biology project, and every aspect of it was a basic cell biology problem. And it really was a way for me to, and he actually, within 2 months, told me, David, you need to write a grant at there's a funny story to how that happened. And it was much too early for me to write a grant, but I did, and he redlined the whole thing and I got the grant. And in retrospect, just a fantastic experience. And during the writing of the grant, I basically taught myself cell biology. I read everything I could get my hands on. I loved it. I loved everything about cell biology. And the project was basically a project of what determines how a protein gets secreted from a cell? We still don't really know the answer to that question, but it was a fundamentally important cell biological question. And all the time that I was working on this project, it was a hard project. And it required enormous intensive focus and labor. But all the time, I had a little voice in the back of my mind saying to me, David, you have to develop something independent. Everybody told me, don't go into Harvey's lab. He's too dominating, and you'll never get an independent thing. And I said, I'm never going to be independent anyway. So, but that gnawed at my head, and I remember these kids with the alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency had a protein. And that protein was stuck in their liver cells. So this was a problem of protein secretion. So that's how I got started. And an idea for how to study it. And that idea turned out to be a great set of ideas that opened the door to what became a fantastic focus for a career. And I was also lucky because I was able to continue the work that I was doing with Harvey while I developed that area. And I tell people many times, don't leave your mentor too soon. Don't think that that independence thing is so important so quickly. Developing all the characteristics of a scientist take time. So that's how I got into that story.
So, what exactly is ATD? Who gets it? How is it treated?
So it's a genetic disorder. It's a single nucleotide substitution that leads to a single amino acid substitution that forces a secretory protein to misfold. And that particular structure has the propensity to aggregate. And the accumulation of aberrantly aggregated protein damages the liver cell function. It is most well known as a cause of emphysema because the alpha-1 antitrypsin, when it's secreted, functions in the blood as an inhibitor of neutrophil proteases, particularly neutrophil elastase. And those neutrophil proteases can destroy the elastic backbone of the lung if they are not regulated by the inhibitor. So this was a disorder that was discovered in the 1950s. It was discovered in people with emphysema. And only later was it discovered that a small subgroup of those who are homozygous for the genetic defect have this, what's called gain of toxic function in their liver. And what's most interesting about this disease, and it's present in every population, it's most common in Northern European ancestries. What's most extraordinarily interesting about this genetic disease is most of those affected by it have figured out a way to not have problems with the aggregated protein. So that is to say that their cells adapt and protect themselves from this aggregated protein. And that has turned out to be a key part of understanding. And of course, it's an example of what we call aggregation-prone proteins, which turn out to be many, many important, particularly degenerative diseases of aging, and particularly neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's, ALS, all are aggregation-prone proteins.
So a lot of your work has been studying and describing the cellular process of autophagy. Can you describe what is autophagy and how is it involved in the healthy and diseased functions of the liver?
Autophagy is the process by which cells degrade abnormal proteins, abnormal lipids. It's also a process for turning over worn out organelles, and it also plays a role in ridding cells of microbes. And I use it as a vacuum cleaner of the vacuum cleaners of the cell, because basically what happens is a little vesicle forms in the cell and envelops the thing that needs to be degraded. And then it fuses with the lysosome, which is a closed sac inside the cell where everything goes to be destroyed. This is the most powerful degradation system of the cell. It is the most marvelous way for the cell to practice quality control. And the reason I say that is because if the cell were going to engage in making everything that it makes perfectly, it would have to spend so much energy. By having a mechanism like autophagy to do the quality control, the pressure is not on for everything to be made perfectly, because as long as the garbage disposal system is working, you end up with the product of perfection that you needed. So this is, and it turns out this declines with aging, and we know from a bunch of very important experiments that if you reconstitute this system in middle age, in many different kinds of experimental organism systems, that you can slow degenerative diseases and prolong lifespan. So we know that this mechanism is fundamental to the health of the cell, and that mechanism can be exploited for therapeutics that might potentially be able to prevent and treat really bad degenerative diseases. We started on the path of this with the alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, and now over, you know, this started in the late 1990s, 2000. Over a 25-year period, we've been able to show how important this system is. And probably most recently, well, I have a paper that just was accepted this week that comes full circle to the to almost what the purpose of my work was. And so the lab, I have always been obsessed with this question, why is it that some people have this, get liver disease, and some don't? And the paper that's just been accepted this week was a paper that has taken a long time, where we studied three boys, siblings, three brothers, all three of whom are homozygous for antitrypsin Z, the classical form of the deficiency, but only one of them has had liver disease. The middle boy had a liver transplant at 18 months of age. His older brother and his younger brother are completely fine, and now they're all in their 20s. The very successful liver transplant, the middle boy is on a very small dose of immunosuppression, but living a normal life, and his two brothers have never had any problem. And this family came to me while I was here in St. Louis from Spain, and I evaluated the middle boy and went ahead and recommended that they go ahead with the liver transplant at that time. But about 20 years ago, I went back and I said, you know, I asked them to participate in a study where we did sequencing of their genome. And we asked the question, could we identify traits that made the index subject susceptible and the and his SIBs protected from the... And the prediction, of course, was that there would be some heterozygous variant within the autophagy system that predisposed him. And the paper shows in a marvelous way that that was correct. We identified two genes, and we identified that if you corrected those genes in the what we call IHEP, we took fibroblasts from the boys themselves, we turned them into liver cells by what's called IPS technology. And then we introduced the variants or corrected them in the appropriate case. And we were able to show that we could reverse the problem in the index subject and introduce the problem in his SIBs by manipulating two genes, each of which is plays a role in autophagy. So this is full circle for me, showing the importance of autophagy in that disease. But now we are working on a set of very, very exciting drug candidates that stimulate the system as potential treatments, not just for antitrypsin deficiency, but for Huntington's disease, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease. And here at WashU, we have people working in all those areas, and we can easily test these drugs, and it's been a fantastic project.
And there has been a lot of work, especially recently, linking autophagy to neurologic disease. Can you describe what some of those links are?
I think probably the most, there's definitely an autophagy gene that increases susceptibility to Parkinson's disease. There is actually a phenomenal story that if you knock out autophagy function in neurons of normal mice, they undergo degeneration. They undergo neurodegeneration, which is an amazing observation that indicates that basically our neurons and all of our other cells are in a constant yin and yang where we're making proteins and lipids and other chemicals in our cells that need to be disposed of. And when the autophagy system is not there to dispose of them, they build up and cause dysfunction. And so this is the yin and yang. It's really part of our physiology. Amazing, amazing stuff.
And how has your understanding of autophagy evolved over the course of your career?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, as soon as I began working on it, I felt the enormity. It's interesting, Will, that takes me back over 24 years ago, 25, 26 years ago. So you might ask me, you know, how have you been able to contain your enthusiasm for 25 or 26 years? And I wouldn't know how to answer you on that, because I've known all along that this had enormous potential. There was a time during that. And what happens to you when you get to the level of science that I've had the fortune of being at is you get invited to meetings all over the world. You meet all the people who are doing the leading work in the area, and you're at meetings with them, and you get to know them, and then you review their papers, and they review your papers. And so you're in this world. And for a long time, in fact, there were only a few people in this world. I recently had the privilege of hosting Noboru Mitsushima here for a symposium. We had invited Noboru during COVID, and we couldn't get him. He works in Japan. He was a mentee of Yoshinori Osomi, who won the Nobel Prize in 2006 for characterizing the genes of autophagy in yeast. And Noboru and I did a collaboration in 2005, and he brought pictures of when we were together back then. And it was a moment in which I realized that at that time, there were very, very few people in the field. Now it's exploded. So I knew early on the enormity of this. And it's taken that amount of time for the science to get to where it's now palpable that we can do something. There was a time when the idea of enhancing autophagy function therapeutically was thought to be a bad idea. And I think for reasons that were interesting, but now turn out to not be that. I've been sitting on it for a long time, Will.
Now, what do you see is the future for the treatment of ATD, and what avenues is your lab currently taking
Well,
in furthering that?
we are solely focused on the autophagy drug approach. Now, I have learned over the years you have to focus, and so we are completely focused on that. There are several other interesting, I mean, I think ultimately this is one of those diseases where a genome editing approach is likely to be a very successful approach. Antisense RNA looks like it's promising. So what's fun is to see that there are going to be multiple things developed in the next few years for this.
That's very exciting. And the last question I have to wrap up this interview is a question that we ask all of our guests. What advice do you have for young scientists and college students going forward in their careers?
Well, I might say something different, Will, for a college student, but for a young scientist, I would say immerse yourself. If anything has helped me to be successful as a scientist, it's reading, 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 going to seminars, talking to people, and it never stops. It never stops. I will pick articles till today. I have a pretty big job, but I still pick articles. I probably read 25, 30 articles a week from scientific journals. And I also have a habit of picking things that are tangential. And it's been a huge success factor for me. I described to you how, when I was asked to write this grant, 2 months into being in the lab, I went and I dove in to every textbook on cell biology. And I was so enthralled. I just immersed myself. So I think that's, and science is such a beautiful, there's so many beautiful aspects to what you do in the world of science. And for a college student, I have a little different philosophy. It's the same, immerse yourself, but in a lot of things. It's not in focus things. You get that opportunity at that level to learn a lot of different things, and that's got such value to it. And of course, you're at the end of it, so you can tell me. I mean, being a pre-med, you're also forced to focus in those areas. And then each step of the way, you'll be able to focus more narrowly, and immersing yourself is absolutely success factor and a joy.
Dean Perlmutter was amazing to talk to, and we are very thankful for him giving us his time. Running a medical school is an extremely difficult task, but Dean Perlmutter does it masterfully.
After highly successful stints at Harvard Medical School and University of Pittsburgh, we're lucky to have him back at WashU. Also, his contributions to understanding the role of autophagy in diseases have been broadly impactful and led to important developments in treatments.
If you like the Masterminds podcast, you can support us by following us on Spotify or subscribing on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Masterminds Pod. Please leave any comments on any of our latest posts if there are any topics or guests you would like to include on future episodes. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Masterminds.